Welcome to Money for the Rest of Us Plus. This is the premium podcast episode for Plus members, episode 244. I'm recording this Friday, March 15th, 2019. In today's episode, we're going to look at Joel Greenblatt's magic formula for investing. We'll review a commodity trading advisor that uses trend following strategies and talk a little bit about what is trend following. And finally, I have a question from a member on the timing of Social Security payments. First, got an email from a member and asked, could I talk about using the tool magicformulainvesting.com? He continues, it's Hal Gotham, which is an investment firm that Joel Greenblatt and his partners own. It's how they pick their stocks. And this member pointed out they've consistently outperformed the S&P 500 since inception. I looked at the website, and I couldn't figure out how they're picking the stock. It's a screening tool for picking individual stocks. But I wanted to figure out, well, how are they doing it? And Greenblatt's done a good job. The book has done very well. He's got a book called The Little Book That Beats the Market. Came out in 2005. There's a follow-up book, The Little Book That Still Beats the Market. I've never read it. So I bought it because I couldn't find the formula. And I figured, it's worth $9. So I bought the book to figure out what is the magic formula. The approach is to rank companies based on some valuation criteria and based on profits. The specific measure is earnings yield. A little different than what we show on Money for the Rest of Us Plus, which is effectively the earnings divided by price. In this case, they're looking at pre-tax operating earnings to what they call enterprise value, which would be the market capitalization or the value of the equity plus any interest-bearing debt. So it's a little different, but the idea is what is the company earning in terms of the total value of the company. The second ranking screen is return on capital, which they define as earnings before interest and taxes divided by net working capital, which would be the current assets minus the current liabilities, plus any additional longer-term fixed assets. The ideal there is to figure out, well, what's the rate of return, the profitability. This is how they manage money. So you can use the screens to select companies. Gotham also manages a number of mutual funds using the strategy. And so the first thing I wanted to know is, well, how have they done? The magic money formula, I think I just said that wrong. Magic formula for investing. The magic. I've been thinking so much about magical money trees and MMT recently. But on that site, they mention one of the funds that Gotham manages is the Gotham Index Plus Institutional. And I thought, well, that would be an interesting one to look at. Its ticker is GINDX. And then I saw on Morningstar that the expense ratio was 3.39%. And I thought, what? Turns out they're getting exposure to the S&P 500, and then they're adding through swap or options, the portable alpha strategy. Then they have an overlay comprised of 263 long holdings, 234 short holdings, essentially a long short strategy. And then whatever excess return that generates, it's added to the S&P 500, less fees. Complicated. But you got this drag of this 3.39% expense ratio. The fund's only been up for 3 years. It's returned 14.1% versus 13.9% for the S&P 500. But gross of fees, pretty incredible performance. I mean, it shows that they've been able to add value, but it's that fee drag. But that suggests that, hey, maybe there's some merit to this magic formula. I then found a fund that's more long only, the Gotham Large Value Institutional Fund. The expense ratio is 0.75%. It owns 233 stocks. Now, what caused me to pause there is the portfolio turnover was 670%, which is extremely high. I mean, you're holding securities for only some for only a month or so. The magic formula of investing talked about, or the book itself talked about holding these securities for at least a year so that it reduces your tax burden. But the Gotham Large Value Institutional Fund return has actually outperformed since inception, 13.6 versus 12.6%. That was through year end 2018. The 3-year performance through yesterday, it underperformed 13.6 versus 13.9%. But with that very high turnover, it means the tax drag. Morningstar estimates that the performance would be about 2 percentage points lower on an after-tax basis. So very much less competitive, essentially underperforming the market after fees and taxes. What's interesting, though, is that I liked the book in the sense that Greenblatt was very upfront that this strategy, as in many active strategies, don't outperform every single year. He writes, "The Magic Formula portfolio fared poorly relative to the market averages in 5 out of every 12 months tested. For full-year periods, the Magic Formula failed to beat the market averages once every 4 years. For 1 out of every 6 periods tested, the Magic Formula did poorly for more than 2 years in a row. During those wonderful 17 years for the Magic Formula, there were even some periods when the formula did worse than the overall market for 3 years in a row, such as it's doing now, at least in terms of that large cap value fund." And here's the key, he continues, "Think it's easy to stick with a formula that hasn't worked for several years? Do you think the typical reaction goes something like, I know this hasn't worked for a long time, or I know I just lost a lot of money, but let's keep doing what we're doing. I assure you, it is not." So what's the point, he asked? The point is that if the magic formula worked all the time, everyone would probably use it. If everyone used it, it would probably stop working. So many people would be buying the shares of the bargain price stocks selected by the magic formula that the prices of those shares would be pushed higher almost immediately. In other words, if everyone used the formula, the bargains would disappear and the magic formula would be ruined. That's true. It is very difficult to hold on to an underperforming strategy. And if everybody did, that's why value works over time, because investors get discouraged. It's more appealing to invest in fast-growing growth stocks. That's where everybody piles in. And then when those growth companies disappoint, the stocks crater. Whereas value, if you buy a value index, it's embedded with positive surprises. The basket of undervalued securities where expectations are low, and that can lead to outperformance over time. And one way to do that, like I do in my portfolio, is with fundamental indexing or some other type of a value smart beta factor. But it doesn't work all the time. And if everybody discovers something and wants to use it, then that excess return can go away. I thought about this morning. I got a call. Hardly ever get phone calls now, which is great. I didn't answer because I didn't know who it was. It was a Philadelphia number. But turned out, and I called him back, turned out to be an investment manager that used to manage or still manages money for one of my former clients. And they thought that I was still the investment advisor to this client. 7 years later, I've been gone 7 years, and they're calling me up, letting me know that they're going to reduce the fee for this client. Now, this client's based in New Mexico. I actually had dinner with, Pearl and I had dinner with them last year. I hadn't seen them in 5 or 6 years. It's a private foundation. And they actually, in that dinner, pointed out to me that this manager from Philadelphia that called me was their best performing manager. This manager, our research team recommended terminating about 8 or 9 years ago because there was, I don't even remember why. Performance was struggling, but that wouldn't have been the main reason. There was something organizationally. You're always, whenever you have an active manager, you're trying to figure out, are the characteristics that led to the outperformance continuing? Is the investment culture there? The people, the process. And this analyst, and had the backing of the investment policy committee, which included me, voted to terminate the manager. It was a hard decision. I don't remember it very well. I believe I probably went to Philadelphia with this manager or with this analyst to help do the due diligence. I certainly had been there several times on my own. I just don't recall. But we made the recommendation. I backed the recommendation. This client said, no, we're not going to fire him. We're going to keep him. And the manager's done very, very well. But not every year, and that's the thing about active management. It's very, very difficult, and it's hard looking forward to say, is this manager going to continue to outperform? But the magic formula seems to work. It's a question of how you implement it. Obviously, most of us can't buy 263 stocks. And so then you're figuring out, all right, here are the top stocks. I'm going to hold them. How long? And it becomes very, very difficult. But that's my thoughts on that. I'm going to try it out. Anytime you're buying a stock, an individual stock, you're suggesting that you have some type of edge, that the stock is not priced correctly, that it's undervalued. And it's an undervalued company, and investors are not paying enough given the level of profitability. That's what this formula is based on. And that's what you're doing, but you have to be patient. As individual investors, we can be more patient. One of the challenges with professional money management is clients are not patient because you never know if a manager is underperforming, has something changed, or is just one of those normal periods of underperformance, just like these periods of underperformance you have for the magic formula. In that regard, then, I got another email from a different member regarding a manager called Dunn Capital. They're a commodity trading advisor using a trend following strategy, which means they're investing in commodity futures, agriculture futures, energy futures, I think even some interest rate futures. This member says, I like their 8% annualized return over the past 5 years. I like the fact that they have a low correlation to the S&P 500. They've returned 12.6% compounded since 1984. Their fee structure, they charge 25% of new trading profits, but they don't charge a fee. They have a clawback, essentially. So if they lose money, they don't start charging a fee until they've actually it's called a high watermark, not a clawback, a high watermark. If they lose 25% in the first year, they don't start collecting a fee until they've actually gained back. So you're back to even. But it's a 25% fee. I mean, that's high. I mean, it's like a hedge fund. He mentioned this would be a good time to buy because they've had a period of poor performance in 2018. The negatives, he says, they're a black box. They do trend following, but the details of how they do it are unknown. And the minimum investment's $100,000. Maximum drawdown is 30%. Here's the thing about how they're investing. Trend following means they're looking at particular commodity futures that are either rising in price, in which case they're going long, or the trend is negative, which means they're going short, and they're buying some combination of these futures. Now, the future market is a zero-sum game. We talked about this several episodes ago in terms of trading. Should you trade? It's a zero-sum game. For your winnings as a commodities future investor are funded by the losses of those that lose, that lost the trade. So you're competing. And you look at their performance, and it is volatile. Here's what they show. So their total return for the 60 months ending, I guess it was January, was 7%. And there is a low correlation, only a 0.12% correlation, which means you get a diversification benefit by investing them. As the markets go up, this might be going down. It's not moving in tandem with the market. 52% of the times, the months, they have a positive return, 48% a negative. So there's just like in that trading episode, there's just a slight edge. They're only right 52% of the time. And their average monthly gain is 5.7%. And their average monthly loss is 4.4%. The difference between winning and losing is pretty small when you're investing in a zero-sum game. The question is, will they be able to continue to maintain their edge with more algorithms, more bots out there? Will it persist? What's interesting, though, is what we have to kind of compare. Well, how has the overall commodities market done? And from that standpoint, over the past 5 years, yes, they've returned 7%. But had you bought a commodities ETF that's also just rolling over long-only futures, DBC is an example, it lost 9 to 10% annualized over the past 5 years. So from that aspect, their ability to go short as well as long has been additive. They've added value, but you know, $100,000 is a lot of money. But institutions will, and we used to do that as an institutional advisor, we invested some in commodity trading advisors because those that can do it well are able to play both sides. They can go long, they go short, and you get the low correlation. But you never know what they're doing. They're just deciding that the trend is going to continue or something along those lines. They have been successful, but it is volatile. It's expensive, but they've done well. So that's really an interesting strategy. Finally, I got an email from a member. He turned 66 this May, eligible to take full Social Security. If he took it now, it would be $2,500 a month, so about $30,000 per year. He waits until he's 70, he'll get $3,500 a month. This is the calculation we talked about back in Plus episode 134, and I did a spreadsheet, which I'll link to in the show notes of this episode, so you can kind of go through the numbers. But we're trying to figure out, if you take it now, you can invest that money versus taking it when you're 70. The way that this sets up, if he waits till he's 70, he'll get an extra 40% per month for the rest of his life. Whereas if he takes the money now, he has 4 years of getting a lower payment that could be invested. At some point, there's a break even where he's investing that money for 4 years. Then at 70, he starts taking. The option is to take the higher amount. Because it is a higher amount, you eventually get enough back to offset that 4 years of payments you receive that you've been investing. From an actuarial standpoint, you would expect that break even to be about the individual's life expectancy. And it is. That break even amount is around 81 years when I did the calculation. I assumed, and he assumed in his analysis, that you're earning 3% on the investments, and I assumed a 2.5% cost of living adjustment because Social Security, as you know, goes up by some measure of inflation. 81 years is the break even. At that point, at age 82, you're getting $57,000 for the higher amount if he had delayed taking it till 70 versus 45,000 for the lower amount if you'd taken it earlier. So it's about a $12,000 difference. And this is where it's key. Delaying Social Security is most beneficial if you live beyond your expected life span. If you live beyond 81, because then you're getting that higher amount. So that by the time you're 90, you've received an additional $109,000 in benefits and earnings on those investments by the time you're 90. And by the time you're 90, you're getting $15,000 more per year. So, and that's significant. It's a form of longevity insurance. So what should he do? His question is, I've done the math. What are other considerations? I plan to continue to work full-time until I'm 69. Then maybe take a year off and probably go back to work part-time thereafter. I really don't need the money to live on, at least for the next 3 years. Well, in that case, if you don't need the money, I wouldn't take Social Security. Because, and I've done this analysis for family members where they've taken the money because they needed the Social Security to live on. But if you don't need it, by delaying, you get a higher payment. And the benefit of that is a form of longevity insurance. If you live to be 81, 82 or longer, then you would have been better off delaying taking Social Security. Other considerations, I'm not a financial advisor, so I don't know if there's some technical tax rule about taxation. Well, at some point, you know, if you're still working full time and taking Social Security, actually, your state, you're getting taxed on it or something like that. But if you don't need it, you just don't take it. One benefit of continuing to work beyond retirement age, according to Social Security, is you can if you earn more in those years, you can continue to accrue Social Security benefits because Social Security is based on your highest earning year. So if you're earning more at age 69, working full-time, and you're earning more than you did when you were, 64, you actually would get a higher Social Security benefit, even if you're actually collecting it. And then there's some method that they accrue or whatever, but they adjust how much you received. And so you can continue to earn additional benefits by continuing to work into retirement age. And so that's an interesting feature that I did not know that. That is Plus Episode 244.